Thank you. So this is, again, like one and done, and this is work by our students, by our students, Monjur Alam, Haider Khan, Momita Day, Nishit Sinha, and our postdoc Robert Callan, and then my colleague Alan Kazajic and me. These students have different expertises because, as you will see, this attack required kind of like a lot of cross the stack, you know, work. So the motivation for this is that, you know, public key crypto, as you have seen already in the previous talk, is essential for modern security, secure exchange of session keys, verifying identity of systems and users, and a lot more. And that means that private keys are highly valuable assets, so attackers want them, and we don't want them to have them. So for a, in a good public key, algorithm, you will design, like for example, RSA, it was designed to make private keys very, very hard to recover given messages. So essentially you have the good guys supply the key to some sort of a RSA black box, and then the message comes in, it comes out encrypted, let's say, with the private key. And the idea is that, the bad guys, in this case Sauron, because, everybody keeps pounding on Eve, so I'm like, okay, let's use something else. So if Sauron here observes the messages, and even if Sauron here observes a lot of message pairs, Sauron still doesn't really get the keys. So analog side-channel attacks, what they do is basically they rely on the cryptographic implementation running on real hardware that has to do some physical things in order to actually compute. So in the case of the EM attacks, for example, logic gates are switching as you're computing. That causes current flows. Current flows create changes in the surrounding EM field. So by observing the EM field around the device that is carrying out the computation, you essentially get some signals that are about the intermediate states of this black box. So it's, in fact, no longer a pure black box. So now Sauron has a lot more information, and if the side-channel information helps you recover the private key that the algorithm didn't really prepare for, then takes over the world. Now you can do message randomization, which basically says, it prevents essentially things like chosen plaintext attacks and other message-dependent attacks. So if you, however, have something where the message-independent operations are using the key, essentially when you don't really need the messages, you only need the side-channel information. In this case, we can kind of say that like the side-channel information alone eventually enable efficient recovery of the private key, and then of course, take over the world. And then you have our one-and-done attack, which kind of goes one step further. It's basically that the message doesn't matter like before. So essentially, we are relying on essentially just gleaning the information purely about the key from the signal. Plus, we actually only need one message. I mean, we only need you to encrypt or sign with one message. So essentially, in this case, side-channel information alone in a single encryption or signing will enable efficient recovery of the entire private key. And because now we don't need multiple traces, basically, we don't need to observe the side-channel signal multiple times, things are, for example, exponent blinding no longer are helping, because the exponent blinding is meant to prevent you from combining the information about multiple instances of the use of the same key. But because we get everything we need from one use of the key, essentially like a fully blinded implementation, we will still get the key. So let's end. Bad guys win, which is a problem. So let me now tell you like how does this work. So this is OpenSSL's basically modular exponentiation using Montgomery multiplication that was intended to be in constant time, and it's largely is in constant time, so we are not exploiting the non-constant timeness of it. So what it's doing is it's essentially exponentiating message X to the exponent D modulo M, where D is the secret exponent. So there are really two secret exponents. You're doing two of these for DP and DQ, and then knowledge of DP and DQ will basically reveal the secret key. So what we have here is the algorithm essentially is operating by basically working on groups of keys, of groups of bits of the exponents. Essentially starts at the top of the exponent and essentially does kind of like a grade school algorithm, except it does it, let's say, 5 bits at a time. There is a window here. It's always the same number of bits. So in most cases, it's 5. So essentially for each window, for each bit in the window, you will square the result. You will look up one bit of the exponent and add it to the window value. So this is essentially just creating the 5-bit value that is going to be the 5-bit group of the digits in the exponent. And then you will look up the pre-computed message to that exponent, and you will multiply that into the result. Okay, so now the Existing attacks basically focus on looking up the pre-computed values. So essentially, that table there, if you can do a cache attack based on like which of the values you are using, which directly leaks the information about the window value. Let's say which of the 32 possibilities you have. You can attack the OpenSSL has now support for, it actually implements scatter gather, so essentially the pattern of block accesses is always the same no matter what the window value is, to essentially prevent you from using the cache pattern to do that. Then you have the multiplication of the result with what you get from the table. And for example, Genking and others attack in Chess 2015 is exploiting that. Basically, you can craft the message so that when you observe this multiplication signal, you can tell which of the choices was made. And message blinding will prevent that, because crafting the message no longer helps. You kind of, you choose the message, but the actual encryption is working on another message that is then unblinded. And what we focus on is, now both of these are kind of either the cache operations or like a very large multiplication. What we are focusing on is essentially this update. So essentially, at some point, you're getting a bit of your key and you are shifting it essentially into the window value. And it's only scalar operations. This thing is like maybe 10, 15 instructions long, but we are going to try to essentially, what's important here is that this thing directly reads a bit of the key and it totally doesn't depend on the message. So basically, it has nothing to do with the message. And our attack is going to target that, and our new mitigation is going to basically fix it. So now, the measurement setup for this, so we are using an EM side channel. So we have done this on basically, compile OpenSSL for two of the cell phones and one of the IoT development boards. We put a probe a little bit, maybe at 1 inch away from the device, but we are not opening any of the phones. So basically, this is done kind of the phones are as is. And then what you see there is essentially there is this big metal clamp that is holding our probe. The probe is actually a tiny little thing. So the big piece of metal you see is just the arm holding the probe so that we don't have to hold it, because it takes a while to do a lot of tests on this. and then the side channel analysis is basically exploiting recent advances in side channel based program monitoring. So we have Camellia, which is our DARPA Labs project, which is essentially about using analog signals to monitor computational activity to detect control flow deviation and or execution of unknown codes. Essentially, it's a project that intends to use the side channel emanations as a way of verifying that your computer is actually computing what it should. So the advances that we've made there allow us to basically do a lot of things with the signal, and eventually we got that to the point where even a single instruction control flow difference can be detected. So essentially, even if your control flow deviates, the two paths differ in only one instruction, we can still tell you which path you took, which is kind of nice, because we can detect now a single instruction anomaly, like if a virus inserts or changes the execution even by one instruction, we will detect it. But as far as the crypto attacks, this doesn't really help, because it turns out that in this constant time implementation, there is no key dependent control flow. So basically, this by itself does not really allow this our attack. Every encryption has the same control flow sequence, so we cannot use control flow differences for the attack. But what we can do is we can use the very stable and predictable signal features and timing of the signal that is now very, very reliably constant to tell us exactly where in the signal the ISBIT set is executing. So essentially what we are using this tracking of the program is to know exactly which small, small part of the signal is actually computing on the bits of the key, so that we don't have to kind of average a lot of things and so on. So this is what a signal at one of those points looks like, and then down there I have the fragment of the code, which is basically the window computation. It's a, let's say, five iteration loop. So what's happening is Montgomery multiplication is taking quite a while, because it's done on these very large numbers, like 1,000 bits. So that's going to, the arrow is showing kind of this all is just that. And then you have the window value update, which is scalar operations, only a few instructions, so it's a very, very brief period of time, and that's the signal we are really interested in. And then that is done, and you enter another Montgomery multiplication, which will take a while again, okay? So Montgomery multiplications are operating on the message, and what we really want is to get the signal for the window value update and see whether we can actually tell which bit do you have, 0 or a 1, okay? And what helps us find this thing is that there are features in the Montgomery multiplication that turn out to be easy to find. So basically what we found is, for example, that this really rapid rise in the signal is giving a very precise timing information about when that has occurred, and we know exactly where that is in the code for the Montgomery multiplication code. And then, because of the constant timeness, you have a pretty constant amount of time from there to where the window value update begins and to kind of any point inside of it. So essentially, we are able to basically, rather than kind of focus on the entire trace of the signal, for every bit, we know at which like 10 to 15 samples to look at. Okay, so if we zoom in into that part, things are even better because, as you can see, the signals are kind of nicely aligning most of the time. So this is showing four traces of that little part. Two of them are for a zero and two of them are for a one. And you can see that, by and large, they're very similar because even within that computation, there are a lot of things that are just done the same for the zeros and ones. But kind of I would like to call your attention to this part. And also this part where obviously the zeros and the ones are slightly different from each other. And what we now can do is basically just, form training examples of each of these kinds, of each of these cases, and just, for an unknown bit, basically try to classify it according to which one is it closer to. And we don't really use any fancy classification. It's just Euclidean distance between the curves, and just whichever is closer according to Euclidean distance, that's the one we use. And now the question, how well does this recover bits of the DP and DQ? Again, DP is used in one exponentiation, then DQ will be used in another one, but we are going to try to kind of process both of them and get both of them. We train on 15 private key RSA decryptions for which we know the private key. And then when we are recovering the bits of the secret exponents, we are using only one decryption to try to recover them. And this is the results in terms of the percentage of the key bits that we did get correctly after one decryption. So for the Samsung Galaxy Centura phone, we are seeing that it's basically the median is kind of halfway between 99% and 100%. Some of the extractions worked a little bit better than others, but it's basically above 99% for all of them. For the Alcatel Ideal, it turns out that the things are a little bit worse, but still we are kind of around 97%, and the worst case among the keys we observed was still well above 95%. And then for the IoT prototype board, it was again kind of like the Samsung Galaxy Centura phone. Now, in the paper we discuss, why is, for example, the Ideal a little bit worse. It has nothing to do with really like signal quality as much as it has to do with just it has a lot of interrupts, so there is a lot of kind of interference in the timing and so on. So you have this many bits of the exponents. Can you actually recover the full key? Because this still has errors, obviously. We didn't recover 100% of the bits. Well, so we have DP and DQ, but we have them with erasures, which means some of the bits we know are missing. Those bits that edge, we didn't find it, but we know too much time has passed. So we know we are missing a bit there. So essentially, that's an erasure. I know I don't have that bit. Those are relatively easy to recover. There are also errors, bits that we think, we kind of got that edge, we classified the signal, but we misclassified it. And those are the ones that are more problematic because we don't know where those are occurring. Obviously, they're kind of behaving like random errors. So existing branch and prune algorithms are used usually to recover keys once you have some information about the exponents or the keys themselves. And the idea is essentially that what they do is they basically form a hypothesis for what, let's say, the least significant bits of the key are, and then try to expand the key by one bit, use some equations to prune possibilities that are just disagreeing with the fundamental math of RSA. And then also, if you're subject to errors, then basically what you do is you look, okay, I've been expanding this. Do I have recently too many errors? Too many disagreements with what I'm guessing are the exponents and what the signal says are the exponents. And if you have too many errors, it's like, okay, this is unlikely. First I had few errors and suddenly I have too many. I must have made a wrong guess. So you kind of you reject that and try something else. The problem, however, with these approaches is that they assume that errors are uniformly distributed or that they have some sort of a nice statistical distribution that spreads them around. But in our case, actually, errors can occur in bursts because you can have bursts of interference and so on. So basically, if you have a burst of errors, you're going to think this is highly unlikely. All of these have matched. Suddenly, I have six of them that don't match. What are the chances of that? Well, actually, chances are pretty high if you have a bursty error rate. And also this algorithm doesn't explicitly handle erasures, although it can be fixed to do that relatively easily. There is another algorithm which prunes partial solutions that disagree with known bits of DP and DQ. So this is basically an algorithm that is meant to handle erasures. So essentially you expand and keep all the options for bits that you don't know, but those that you do know, you essentially say that, you know, if the bit that I do know disagrees, then obviously this partial solution is bad. Unfortunately, we don't have any bits that we truly do know, because all the bits might be erroneous as far as we know. So we have some erasures, like bits we know we don't have, and then we have some bits that essentially are highly likely to be correct, but we don't know which ones are incorrect. So we needed a method for fixing that. So what we do is we basically kind of take the erasure algorithm, which is essentially trying to just reject partial solutions that disagree, and instead of rejecting those that disagree, we basically penalize them for disagreement. So essentially the algorithm is take partial solutions with the fewer disagreements of all the ones we have so far. We don't count erasures at disagreements. We only count bits that we did get from the signal, that we have a guess for how many of them disagree. Take that, expand it by one bit position, prune those expansions that disagree with the fundamental math of RSA. You're still left with several of the other guesses. Put those in the pool and repeat, okay? So if you have no errors, essentially this will vary, vary, because only the correct solution never disagrees, it has the lowest error, it will basically just go through the entire key and reconstruct it right away. If you have some errors, then they're kind of competing for like which solution has the fewest errors, but with few errors it still works well. How well does it work? Well, this is kind of the how many search steps, how many of these one-bit expansions do you need to do? And if you have zero errors, of course, you need to do as many bit expansions as you have the bits of the key. So essentially, there are like 2,000 of them. As you have, like, so this is 1%, 2%, 3%, and so on. On the right end of the scale, it's still only 10%. But you can see that if you have erasures, that's the bottom curve, you actually still are under 10,000 steps to get the key. If you have only errors, then at like 6, 7%, you start having this significant increase in the amount of effort you need. But you can still recover keys, it's just that it takes more and more effort, and it's quickly growing. And then if you have a 50% mix, then it's like that, the middle curve. So the point is that basically, if you have a mix of these two, you are somewhere in between these curves. And we happen to be essentially kind of at the 50% mix or a little bit lower than it, because it turns out that most of our problems actually happen to be erasures. Like if something has messed up the signal, usually it's messed up so badly that you can't even find where the bit is supposed to be. Okay, so we are, fortunately, we don't have to really worry about it because we are actually in this part of the curve. All of our experiments have been in that part of the curve, which means even if it's all errors, we can still recover it. And we have an algorithm our algorithm's implementation is basically doing about 500,000 steps per second on a single core on this laptop, so it's not even like a server or anything. So in practice, in about a second, you will crack any of the keys we have, actually recover. There is more in the paper about how you train on one device and then attack another one so that you don't have to actually train on the same device you're attacking. The results for that are only slightly worse than when you do same device training and still allows 100% key recovery. A similar attack on a sliding window implementation that was used in previous versions of OpenSSL, but because prior attacks managed to get some of the bits there, it's been kind of substituted, and now they're using fixed window. One and done, of course, can recover like almost all of the bits just like for the fixed window, so it almost doesn't matter which one you use from our perspective. And now let's talk about the mitigation. The fundamental enabler of this attack, other than the signal processing we can do and the demodulation and everything, is that several instructions have very few possibilities. I mean, they're key dependent, their operands are bits of the key, and they have very few possibilities for their operands. So essentially, is bit set returns either a 0 or a 1, and there is actually several instructions that kind of get this 0 or a 1 from one place to the other through the function return and so on. And there is no need to get bits one at a time. Basically, we are using a 5-bit fixed window, which needs 5 consecutive bits from a value. These bits are stored as words in memory, and you could just take a word, shift it the appropriate amount of time, mask it so that you get 5 bits and get 5 bits. So that's what we did. So in fact, we actually take an entire word worth of bits so that there is many possibilities for this, and only really mask out the rest of the bits that we don't need for this window once we have to. So that basically you maintain kind of this confusion among the possibilities for as long as you can. And we never go down to 1 bit. So basically there is never a point where it's actually just 1 bit stands alone and has to be safe in the signal somehow. This kind of 5 bit at a time takes a little bit longer than getting 1 bit, but you actually need to do it only once per window rather than 5 times per window. So it turns out that this is a little bit faster than the previous implementation, and it kind of maintains this. So now the attacker is essentially, instead of making a binary decision based on some amount of signal, they're forced to make for a 5-bit window a 32-way decision on the same amount of signal, essentially. So it's basically about like how much information can the attacker get from the signal, and we're kind of forcing the attacker to kind of decide more based on essentially the same amount of signal. After the mitigation, we get these results. Now, note the scale. Now, like we are a little bit below 50% most of the time. Random guessing would get you here, but this assumes that you're actually guessing all of the bits. What we have here is we are measuring basically how many bits did we get correctly, and it's counting both errors and erasures as we didn't get them. So essentially, we are a little bit lower than 50% because erasures are kind of counting against us. So erasures all count against us, and then among the other ones, we are basically achieving random accuracy, because erasures, one way to solve this would be to essentially just randomly guess for the erasures what the bit would have been, in which case we verify that it's indeed around 50%. So essentially, this is no better than random guessing, and erasures are not really, I mean, you know where the erasures are, but it doesn't really help you anymore. Okay? So in conclusion, we have an analog side channel attack on OpenSSL's constant time modular exponentiation implementation used in RSA, and we get precise timing thanks to constant timeness of the implementation, and we get highly accurate classification of the bit value thanks to the one secret bit at a time implementation. The entire private key is recovered in our attack using only one use of that key. So basically you use the key only once to establish a session or to sign something or to prove your certificate, and that's it. The attack is not affected by blinding at all. Attack directly obtains exponent bits, so message is not relevant, so message blinding just doesn't do anything. And then for our attack, and then exponent blinding does not help against single trace attacks, and this is a single trace attack. For mitigation, what we did is we look up groups of secret bits, not individual bits. So essentially, we just kind of increase the confusion for the attacker, and that at least prevents the single trace attacks. We didn't try to do, like, what if I do a million traces or something. But blinding is helping with that anyway. So that's it.
Great talk. Thank you very much for that insight.
Thank you.
Do you know any other implementation which could be vulnerable? Did you look in it? Or
We're trying to look at it. I mean, it's just like we essentially try to understand also like why is this working and so on. And it seems to be this basically, although there's small, I mean, they're scalar up, they're essentially just a few instructions, but the problem is that we know exactly where they are in the signal.
Yeah.
So we're looking at other implementations to see if they have similar properties in terms of how they're coded.
Okay, if I'm allowed to do the next question, does the speed of the processor does anything to your measurements?
So we have done experiments to show basically like what does this depend on, as in can we do it or not, and it turns out that bandwidth, like how much bandwidth in the signal you have, is it's important, and it's kind of related to the frequency of the processor, but we have found that like essentially these are all like 1-ish gigahertz processors, so this is not like your really, really slow processor. So slower processors are even easier to attack. The faster ones we haven't tried yet, but we found that we need only 40 megahertz of bandwidth to attack a 1 gigahertz processor. So it's about like a 4% of the clock frequency. So probably to attack something that operates at 3, 4 gigahertz, we would need like a proportional increase in bandwidth. Plus our matching, like our tracking where we are in the program, gets a little bit more complicated because it's an out-of-order processor and so on. So we are still working on it. But bandwidth essentially is a problem, as in you need more of it. But it's not like we need like 3 gigahertz of bandwidth.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
So what is the cost of your test equipment,
The
analog equipment, and could this be used against, like, secure processors?
As far as the cost of the test equipment is concerned, we have for this paper, we have done the experiments with a spectrum analyzer, which is, like, maybe 30 $30,000. $30,000. But the amount of, I mean, that's because that one can go all the way, like up to 160 megahertz of bandwidth, and just we didn't want to kind of like, oh, the equipment is not good enough, right? We have found, however, that if you reduce the bandwidth to 40 megahertz, it still works. So there is now equipment, basically we believe that this can be done with like software-defined radios and so on. I mean, there are some that actually have like about the same sampling rate as the spectrum analyzer. They're like $5,000. And then we actually have these tiny little USRPs that are essentially $700. And the antenna is basically dirt cheap. I mean, you make one for like $10. So I mean, one of the problems with side channel attacks is essentially that equipment necessary to do pretty fancy attacks in terms of demodulation and stuff like that is getting a lot cheaper. These things are now integrated fully, and you can buy them as radio receivers and so on.
And could you use this against secure processors?
Against secure processors, we don't know. We haven't tested it. So basically, as long as the processor still fundamentally operates, I mean, so basically if you implement this RSA under some sort of enclave or something like that, but fundamentally still needs to do something that is a zero or a one, then we would probably it wouldn't matter, basically, because the essentially memory encryption and isolation and so on don't do anything against essentially the fact that you eventually have to operate on a zero or a one. But we haven't tried, so it's not like I cannot confirm that we can do it on SGX or something.
Hey, do you have any issues with when you have an erasure getting out of sync with the bits in the key?
Yes and no. I mean, it can happen, but most of the time, basically, what's happening is the erasure happens when essentially something else is happening in the system, and it creates kind of like a spike in the signal, or some of these are near the cell phone band, so we also get like interference from other things. So basically, there are these kind of bursts of essentially the signal. I mean, you can all. If you look at the signal visually, you can say, oh, this is garbage, basically. But what you can do is essentially say, okay, the timing for the bits is such that, you know, I think I'm missing 5 bits. So in the worst-case scenario is basically you would have to take that as a kind of hypothesis in your recovery of the key and say, okay, you know, this could be a 0, this could be a 1, or I could be actually having a slip in the number of bits and just decode it that way. But we haven't really had that problem yet.
And have you tried applying this to key generation as well?
In what sense?
I mean, RSA key generation, prime search, that sort of thing.
Oh, that we haven't. Probably because it's very similar math. You know, if it's using essentially the same functions, because we are not really attacking RSA as much as we are just this implementation of the modular exponentiation. So anything that uses it has pretty much the same properties, as in it's revealing exponents with a very, very high accuracy.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.